This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In an age when everything seems to have been explored, many of the millions of caves hidden beneath the surface of the earth are still uncharted. My guest, Michael Ray Taylor, has been exploring caves since 1979 and has written several books about them. His latest, Caves: Exploring Hidden Realms, is a companion to a new IMAX movie. Taylor describes caving as being in the midst of a golden age of discovery, comparable to the jungle penetrations of the last century or the mountain conquests of Edmund Hillary's day. Because no sunlight penetrates there, caves are inhospitable to most plant and animal life. But exotic life flourishes there, including microorganisms known as extremophiles, because they live in such extreme environments, environments that may be closer to the landscapes of other planets. In fact, NASA is studying cave microorganisms to better understand what life forms on other planets might be like. I asked Taylor to describe some of the unusual characteristics of cave-dwelling microorganisms.
Well, my favorite extremophile, it's not one organism, but it's actually a whole colony of thousands of different organisms. But they live together in a specialized kind of microbial mat that right now is only known in one cave. It's in Mexico. It's called Villa Luz. And these things that grow in the caves, a caver named Jim Pizarrowitz named them snotites. They are, if you can picture your typical stalactite, only instead of being made of rock, it's made of a jelly-like substance that sways in the breeze and drips pure sulfuric acid. These are living curtains, and the acid comes from the poisonous hydrogen sulfide gas in the cave. They use it for food. They convert this hydrogen sulfide gas into acid. The acid drips down, hollows out more cave. So in essence, they've created their own environment. They're the reason the cave exists in the first place. And it's like something from a science fiction movie to walk into a room like this wearing a gas mask, avoiding the acid so it doesn't eat through your clothes, and see that life has adapted.
Is it named after snot? I mean,
yes, it's named after snot. It looked okay. Like a big curtain of snot. So the guy who discovered them named them snotites. And the name has stuck. Even in, you know, you get scientific papers now at major universities on snotites.
And what are troglobites?
There are technical definitions between what's a troglobite and what's a troglodyte, and it has to do with life that is common on the surface but has somehow adapted to the caves. Some animals live just in the light zone of the caves near the entrance. Others are completely cave-adapted, you know, the famous blind fish that you get in caves in Kentucky and a few other places that have lost their eyes completely. They've lost all their skin pigmentation. They are genetically dependent on life in the cave. Although, interestingly, there was recently a study of a cave in Mexico where the underground river flows past this big opening to the surface, and the blind cave fish in this cave, in this skylit area, have, after who knows how many thousands of generations, have gotten their eyes back. And through genetic analysis of the fish, you can tell they lost them in ancient generations, and in recent generations, they got them back. Most troglobites are like that. They're surface animals that have become cavers, kind of like people. But then the bacteria that I've been studying more recently are dependent on the cave and could not exist anywhere else.
Are scientists speculating that some of these microorganisms in caves might prove useful to people?
Well, some scientists are doing more than speculate. In the same way that scientists go to the rainforest for natural products and, you know, herbal medicines that can be turned into prescription medicines, scientists are studying the chemical properties of these organisms. If you consider the genetic diversity of life on Earth, the bacteria are much more diverse than the larger organisms. That means that any two bacteria in a cave pool are probably much more distant relatives than I am to a corn plant. And when you get that genetic diversity, you get lots of strategies of this is how I'm going to fight off invaders. So that means lots of new medicines potentially. There's a guy named Larry Mallory that I've accompanied on several cave collections around the world, and he has a company that's developing drugs from cave organisms. They've had some very promising early results of a particular organism that seems to secrete a chemical that goes after breast cancer. Doesn't harm other types of cancer, doesn't harm healthy cells, but there's something about a breast cancer cell that mimics a natural enemy it has in the cave. And so they are in the long and unfortunately drawn out process of creating and bringing to market a drug based on this. They've also found two or three new types of antibiotics, and with various bacteria that we've been able to treat for with antibiotics for much of the 20th century, now suddenly becoming resistant to those antibiotics, we need some new antibiotics to come into the market in the next century. And I think a lot of them may actually come from caves and other extreme environments.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Ray Taylor, and he's the author of the new book, Caves, Exploring Hidden Realms, and it's a companion book to a new IMAX film called Journeys into Amazing Caves. Michael Ray Taylor has been caving for years and is the author of a couple of other books about caves as well. Let's talk a little bit about underwater caves. Just describe one underwater cave that you've been to for us.
Well, in the course of traveling with the IMAX crew, which made the film Journey into Amazing Caves, one of the two stars of the film, Hazel Barton, is a certified cave diver who invited me to accompany her into a collection area that's featured in the film. And this was in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. And the unique thing about these caves as compared to other underwater caves, they're relatively shallow. The water's 30 to 40 feet deep. And the caves were all dry during the last ice age when sea levels were lower, all the water was up in the ice cap. And so they formed the dripstone formations that can grow only in air, you know, beautiful stalactites, draperies, flowstone, stalagmites, columns, and so forth. So these are very well decorated and pretty rooms, which make them great on the IMAX film. But for me as a caver who normally has to do a lot of climbing and crawling and rappelling to get to a place like this, to float through it with dive gear was like being weightless. So it was a wonderful sensation to just glide effortlessly past these wonderful formations, floating along with the lights. Our dive lights would reflect off them in the water in interesting patterns. Just very pretty.
Now, there are certain problems that cavers experience when they're swimming deep under the ground.
Yeah, cave diving is extremely dangerous. It's caving itself is something that almost anybody can do if they're with a good guide and if they have a couple of hours of training prior to going underground. Cave diving, on the other hand, I would no more, without proper training, sit down and try to fly an Air Force jet than I would try to cave dive without proper training, because there are so many ways you can mess up and die. It's that simple. I get lost in caves from time to time. It's the way you get lost in a shopping mall. You have to backtrack your steps a few ways and figure out where you got turned around. But if you have 30 minutes of air on your back and you're lost and it takes you 45 minutes to find your way, then you're not leaving the cave. And there are so many ways to become disoriented, to have a gear failure. You have to be able to deal with any emergency quickly and with a calm head. I go on a lot of trips with cave divers where I haul their tanks into the cave, and I'll get to a certain point and I'll say, well, I'll be the guy waiting for you. I hope you have a good dive. It's extremely dangerous. There's no way around it.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the animal life that you've found in caves. Why don't we start with the most commonly known one, which is bats. You were once in a cave with 40,000 bats?
Well, 40,000 is a conservative number. There were 40,000 in the air around me in that particular passage. I think the cave itself may have had as many as 500,000 bats, and I've been in other caves that have colonies of up to 20 million bats. It is what you would expect it to be as an experience. It's a little creepy. It's a horror movie sort of sensation when they're wheeling around your head in a bat flight on the way out of the cave to feed at night. But at the same time, cavers everywhere have a deep respect for bats because being in close proximity with them all the time, we've studied them and learned that they're really beneficial to the environment. And they've been persecuted for a long time. And so cavers will go out of their ways to preserve bats, to avoid caves where threatened bats live, or to avoid caves where there's nursery colonies or the bats are hibernating. The cave I wrote about with the 40,000 bats screaming around me was in the tropics in Jamaica, and the bats were not hibernating. They were not a threatened species, and they were in between the group I was with and the passage we hoped to go explore. So there was nothing for it but to plow on through the bats. And these were big tropical bats. Most North American bats, if you know, it's the size of a little mouse with wings. They're tiny little creatures. They couldn't really hurt you if they wanted to in most cases. The tropical bats get a little bit bigger, a little more horror movie-like in terms of the experience. And yet at the same time, it's their environment, and I respect it whenever I'm going through it.
What do the bats contribute to the environment?
Well, many things. Probably the best thing in the U.S., and especially the southeast and southwestern states, is they eat mosquitoes. Bats eat either mosquitoes or fruit, or insects or fruit. The ones who eat insects often show a preponderance to go after mosquitoes. There's a cave in Texas that's featured in the IMAX film. It has a year-round colony of around 20 million bats, and they eat something like 500,000 pounds of mosquitoes every night. So they keep the insect population down. Then there are fruit-eating bats, and like birds and bees, they help pollinate and distribute fruits. If you eat peaches, for example, chances are the peach was pollinated not by an insect but by a bat.
Well, there's lots of bats, there's lots of bat guano, which is the word for bat.
Yes, guano is the best natural fertilizer known to man. In fact, I've been known to sometimes bag a little bit of guano whenever I'm on a caving trip and bring it back for the garden because it makes things grow terrifically.
You've also been known to slide down a six-foot hill of bat guano.
Yeah.
That must be a pretty awful experience.
Well, cavers get dirty. And, you know, cavers, they're a different sort of people. They're often very quirky in their habits. And I think at a base level, it comes down to the fact we're like little kids playing in the sandbox. If you want to find the big room, sometimes you have to go through the little muddy places to get to them. So this was on another tropical caving trip. I sledded down a big hill of guano because there was an opening at the base of it, and it was too slick to do anything but slide down it. So I'm covered with slime at the bottom, but there's a little opening, and I feel some air coming out of it, and it's kind of tight, but I can wiggle through, and there's a room on the other side. It just keeps pulling us forward.
Did you ever get caught in a narrow opening?
Yes, I did. Most cavers are very light, small people. My wife describes a lot of my friends as kind of squirrel-like. I am not squirrel-like. I'm about as big as cavers come. I've got a big frame, and there's a passage in West Virginia. It's in a cave called Bone Cave, and Bone Cave connects to Norman Cave in one spot through a squeeze called the Devil's Pinch, and it's got a knife blade of rock running down the center of what's a very tight squeeze. And I went one way from Bone Cave into Norman Cave through it. I'd heard people larger than me had gone through and fit fine. And it was very hard, but by exhaling so that my rib cage got smaller, I could slither through and pop out on the other side. And then we spent a number of hours in the cave on the other side. But coming back, which we had to do because we didn't know the way to the other entrance to the cave that was on the Norman side, something about the angle was just difficult. I couldn't align my body the way I had going through the other direction. And I pushed forward, and I couldn't go any further. And this is the way out of the cave, so I've got to go. So I backed up. I took off my coveralls and passed my coveralls and my pack up to a friend on the other side of the constriction. And so I'm sliding up basically in my underwear, and this blade of rock starts digging into my chest. So I exhale and squeeze forward on my, you know, use my toes and fingers to pull forward. And then I can inhale just about a half inch before my chest is caught on the rock. And eventually I squeeze forward to the point where I literally could not inhale anymore. No breath. I'm stuck in the rock, but I'm within an inch of getting out, and I know it. And I just stuck my hand forward and got a friend to yank from the other side. And he popped me past the constriction. I had a cut on my chest, but I was through. that's the tightest spot I've ever been. I've heard other cavers talk about going into similarly tight places. You have to know by practicing on the surface with a box, this thing called a squeeze box. We test ourselves. We know what's the smallest spot we can fit through, and you shouldn't try to push anything smaller than that.
Michael Ray Taylor is the author of Caves, Exploring Hidden Realms. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Ray Taylor, and he's a caver who is also a journalist and has written a lot about caves. His latest book is called Caves, Exploring Hidden Realms, and it's a companion to an IMAX film called Journey into Amazing Caves. Part of your new book is about ice caves. Would you describe an ice cave that you've visited?
Well, ice caves are very different from what we think of as the more traditional caves in rock because they are so temporary. You know, a cave like Mammoth Cave or Carlsbad Caverns, it's a geological feature that took millions of years to form, and it's not going anywhere anytime soon. Ice caves are ephemeral. They form in glaciers. Glaciers are moving, breathing. When you're inside an ice cave, you can often hear the glacier groaning as it's slowly sliding down the rock beneath it toward the sea. And so ice caves give you sort of a fast-forward view of geology. They take water, runoff water, melt water from the surface. They channel it down toward the bedrock, just as traditional caves channel water from the surface through porous rock. But they're unstable. The vertical shafts in ice cave, and you can see this marvelously in the IMAX film, tend to be among the most dangerous types of vertical caving you can do because big chunks of ice are liable to fall without any warning. This doesn't happen or doesn't happen very often at all in a cave in rock. You know, Hollywood will often show as soon as a group of people in a Hollywood film go into a cave, the ceiling starts falling in. Well, cavers laugh at that because the ceiling in your local mall is more likely to fall in than most caves, which have been there thousands of years. But when you're inside ice, you have to watch every step. You have to anchor yourself to the wall at all times, and sometimes you'll swing a hammer to set an anchor, and a crack will appear like a gunshot that runs for 100 feet, and you'll feel everything shift a little bit. This, in fact, happened to the IMAX crew when they were getting one of the scenes in the movie. They had a camera crew of three people balanced on a block of ice 60 feet off the floor of a 500-foot pit, and this whole block of ice, which was the size of maybe two school buses, without warning, shifted. It only shifted an inch. For a moment, they thought they were just going to crash to their deaths. Luckily, it wasn't shifting any more than that, but they still got out of there very quickly after that.
What are some of the strangest things you found within caves?
Oh, probably what I would call strangest are the things that are not indigenous to the cave, things that have been brought in by other people somehow. I was with a friend in Tennessee one time. We were exploring some pits on a particular mountain that had a number of pits on it. There was this one pit about 130, 140 feet deep. We rappelled to the bottom, and there's a small circular room at the bottom of the pit, and arranged around the perimeter of the room were all these horse skulls, and each one had a black candle melted on top of it. It was like a scene from a horror movie or an AC/DC video, and it creeped us out a little bit. Every once in a while, you come up with something incongruous, an old car that someone has somehow abandoned in a cave miles from any road. But in terms of the natural features of the cave, to me, they're just, I'm excited. I find them wonderful, but it's the excitement one gets from watching birds or walking through a national forest.
When you resurface to the outside world after exploring a cave, how does that world look different to you?
Well, it's most noticeable after a lengthy trip. In the course of doing some of the research on cave microbes, I did a couple of trips into Lechuguilla Cave that lasted 3 days or more. And after several days underground, where the colors you see are various hues of red and orange and just the dull brown earth colors, to get up on the surface world in the New Mexico desert, suddenly the blue looks a lot more blue, the green looks a lot more green. It's a kind of a rebirth. I suppose this is another reason caves were important to so many early societies, that they were symbolic of the act of birth itself. And that's the way you feel when you come out of a cave, changed, and as if you've been to a place no one else will know, and your life is very much enriched by that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about caves.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Michael Ray Taylor's latest book is called Caves, Exploring Hidden Realms. It's the companion book to the new IMAX movie, Journey into Amazing Caves. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.